You've got a process of, that has environmental impact and social impact and economic impact. And the effect of that on rural life, of, on the one hand, people leaving the land, on the other hand, fewer and fewer outlets for work and so on within the countryside, has been a general decay in the very subtle fabric of rural society. And I think there is now a reaction against that. Certainly in Britain there's a realization that the things that went to make up village life are being stripped away.
Hello, I'm Craig Benjamin. This radio program is part of a series titled Hearing the Voice of the Land, Food, Ecology, and Community. The last 50 years have seen a steady erosion of farm communities, not just in Canada, the United States, or England, but to varying degrees throughout the world. The aggressive marketing of artificial pesticides, farm machinery, hybrid seeds, and now biotechnology has typically meant, on the one hand, fewer people producing more food and owning more of the land, and on the other hand, growing rural poverty and landlessness and a steady migration from the country to the city. Today, this process of rural dispossession appears to be accelerating throughout the world. One factor is the extraordinary concentration of wealth and power, which agribusiness corporations have been able to amass. Another factor is the way these corporations have used their power to set the agenda of national agricultural policies and of international trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement and the latest draft of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, with the result that subsidies and other protections for small farm production have been undermined or eliminated. Although these changes will ultimately impact on food consumers, the first victims are farm families and farm communities. And seeing that their very survival is threatened, farmers around the world are fighting back. During the latest GATT negotiations, there were mass demonstrations in India and France. And on January 1, 1994, the day the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect, indigenous farmers from the south of Mexico took up arms to demand the freedom to maintain their way of life. Over the next half hour, I'll be discussing the global farm revolt with Nicholas Hilliard, an environmental journalist, sustainable agriculture activist, and one of the editors of The Ecologist. We recorded this conversation in Mexico City in April 1994. Since perhaps 1991, 1990, there have been around the world uprisings by farmers, the incredible uprisings in India, the uprising here in Mexico, and beginning on January 1st in Chiapas, the demonstrations, the mass demonstrations in France. Although there doesn't appear to be actually an international farmers' movement as such, do you think that these various actions and concerns around the world are in fact linked, that there is a common cause among these farmers?
I think, well, it may be useful to look at that at two levels. I mean, I think at the national level in each of those countries, something really rather remarkable has happened, in that farmers who may not have been talking to each other or seeing common concerns are beginning to come together. This is particularly true in France, particularly true in America, and particularly true in India. But equally, as those common concerns have started to be articulated, and there's a realization that there is an assault on the farming community worldwide, the small farmers particularly. So links are being made between farm groups in different countries. Sometimes those links are first being made by groups outside the farming community. To give one example, recent demonstrations by farmers in India against Cargill. There were demonstrations also elsewhere in Europe by development groups, but those development groups were in touch with and have been feeding information to farm groups. And there is a growing solidarity, I think, between different farm groups around the world, a realization that they are disposable in the new world order.
Well, I'd like to ask then about the particular historical circumstances that farmers face right now, because it seems as though despite the rapid development of industrial agriculture, particularly in the North, and particularly in North America, that this has always gone hand in hand with the survival or the retention of other forms of farm production, small farm production, subsistence production. And there's this whole wealth of literature about why the two are in fact linked and why it's necessary to the global economy that there be small farm production, in part because it is a cheap way to maintain a basic labor supply that can be freely turned off the land and into the cities at will. Is there a particular reason why at this point around the world this old balance between industrial and small farm production seems to be broken?
Well, I don't think there's ever been a balance as such. I think you're right that small farmers have been to an extent supported as a reservoir for labor. I think that's absolutely true. But looking at the northern countries, particularly Europe, which I know best, there's been a historical trend towards pushing small farmers off the land, a historical trend towards larger and larger farms, greater concentrations of land, greater concentrations of growing power, and so on and so forth, and greater efficiency by the bigger farmers in capturing subsidies. That's where their efficiency lies. It's not actually in efficiency of production, it's in capturing the subsidies that are available. So that in the EC, for example, something like 80% of the subsidies go to the large farmers. In North America, you've got, particularly in the US, a system of subsidies whereby the subsidies, although they go to the farmers, actually ultimately end up in the pockets of the large grain corporations. And I think if you look worldwide today at what's happening, the trigger for a revitalization of farm movements has been the GATT Uruguay Round, which for the first time brought agriculture into the GATT agreement. Now, under the new Uruguay Round, countries are going to be forced to open their markets, their agricultural markets, to foreign imports. In cases like India, the 30% that they'll be forced to open is in fact a massive share of their market. And it's quite impossible for small producers to compete against the cheap floods of grain that get subsidized grain, although in theory the subsidies are being taken off, they're not. Subsidized grain that is going to come in from North America and from elsewhere. They simply will be driven off the land. So this is a livelihoods issue. And within Europe, there's also a similar realization that the new structures of agriculture that are coming out of the Uruguay Round are going to just drive people off the land, drive people out of their livelihoods. And I think there's this catalyst of GATT. And in a way, it's done more than just waking up the farm community. I think as in Europe, again, talking of Europe in particular, the actions of French farmers, although perceived initially by many outside the farming community as simply, you know, trying to get more subsidies or whatever, has now woken people up to the threat that GATT poses to their own livelihoods. There's a realization that companies are going to just simply move out of Europe to where they can find the cheapest labor. And there's a realization, too, that although many of the jobs will go to the south, they'll go to the south because wages are low, because working conditions are not regulated to the same degree, because there are very few environmental regulations. In other words, what's emerging is a world order in which workers in South and North are pitted against each other, as opposed to companies being pitted against each other. A new world order in which mass of humanity is simply disposable to the system, that if workers in the South begin to organize to demand higher wages, the company simply moves on. If workers in the North don't accept the deregulation of working conditions, the company will move on. A sort of social dumping in which the mass of humanity is cast onto the rubbish dump. And this comes at a time when governments are looking at the problems in terms of, say, overpopulation, classifying this mass of humanity that their policies have created, it turned into rubbish people, as overpopulation, people to be controlled. And I find that a very frightening new world that we're moving into.
You referred to the large-scale subsidies of certain forms of production in North America and in Europe. I've heard people who have overall a progressive view of the world economy who want to see the economy changed in a way to provide more favorable conditions for small-scale producers in the South argue in favor of free trade, in favor of GATT, because they believe that by removing systems of subsidy and by removing trade barrier, we can finally do away with some of the structured inequalities between producers in the North and the South.
Well, I think there are two things here. First, I'm deeply opposed to subsidies that are simply tied to production, that you get your subsidy if you produce more and more and more and more. That's crazy. But there are other forms of subsidies for organic farming, etc., etc., that could help redirect the direction of agriculture. There are subsidies in the way that subsidies are structured and granted could also be changed very dramatically. At the moment, the largest producers are the ones who capture the bulk of the subsidies. If you were to tier the subsidies so that they were directed to the smaller producers, that would give smaller producers a chance in what is a market in which they're being increasingly squeezed out of. So there are ways in which the subsidy system can be reformed. Now, one of the great myths of GATT is that it's going to do away with subsidies. It's not. Under GATT, under the round that's about to be signed in Marrakesh, subsidies will still be permitted for infrastructure programs in the South. Infrastructure programs that generally will support the large-scale agribusiness type of agriculture. So subsidies for dams, for example, for massive irrigation schemes. These will all still be permitted. Secondly, the GATT is not going to get rid of the subsidy system that you have in, say, America. And I think it's worth looking in some detail at that, because it isn't a subsidy to the farmers. The way that it works is that Congress sets a floor price, and if the price goes below that floor price, the farmers get the difference between what they get in the open market and the cost of production. So what the subsidy system effectively enables the large corporations to do is buy below the cost of production. All the farmer gets is the difference between what he or she's lost out on. The real subsidy is to the grain companies, who can buy cheap because of their storage power. They can then release that cheap grain onto the market when they want to, and they can do so in a way which undermines the smaller peasants, which enables them to squeeze those smaller peasants off the land, enlarge the sort of corporate agribusiness type of farming enterprise, and so on. So it's a subsidy that goes to the corporations. Now, clearly, those who are looking to GATT to get rid of the subsidy system are misguided. I mean, they're looking in the wrong direction. I think that the real challenge now is to reform the subsidy system in such a way that it supports agriculture and supports food production, that generates high quality food, that supports rural communities instead of driving people off the land. These are the real challenges. It's not an out-and-out war on subsidies, and it's a misplaced analysis to see the subsidy system per se as being the root cause of the problem. Subsidies tied to production, yes. Subsidies that end up subsidizing the large corporation, yes. These are the problems.
I'm Craig Benjamin. I'll resume this conversation with Nicholas Hilgert of The Ecologist in just a few seconds' time. Critics of this process, whether looking specifically at industrialization in North America or looking at global processes such as, as you mentioned, GATT, tend to suggest that we are looking at a process that's going to continue on into the future, that this intensification will continue and will become more, all of the elements of it, the intensification of land holdings, the use of pesticides, the turning people off the land, we'll see more and more of that into the future. Is there not, though, a point at which the corporate interests involved in industrial agriculture will, in fact, start to see a loss themselves, that the basis of their profits will be undermined by the destruction of the land, by the destruction of social communities? Looking at international forums such as the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development that was held in Rio, there seems to be some suggestion that large corporations are becoming conscious of the danger of undermining the conditions of their production and want to perhaps pull back from the edge.
I think there is a realization amongst some of the more progressive elements in, progressive would be the wrong word, in the North American context, amongst some corporate heads who are looking perhaps more to the future than the near term future, that environmental destruction will eat into their corporate profits. But I think there's a side of it which needs to be stressed, that the reason that they are now taking environmental concerns and social concerns to an extent seriously is not simply that their scientists or government or someone else at the top has alerted them to these concerns. It's very much that grassroots organizations have brought the environment into their boardrooms, have brought the social issues into their boardrooms. And they also recognize that as degradation of environment begins to eat into the economic fabric, economic profits, that they are in themselves threatened, their way of life is threatened. So I think if you look at UNCED, it's not that this is a flowering of consciousness, environmental consciousness by industry. What I look on UNCED and analyze UNCED in terms of is much more an attempt to capture the environmental debate, to capture the environmental initiative, to turn it to industry's advantage, and to contain environmentalism and the rising social movements, particularly in the South, that are rebelling against development. You mentioned the recent rebellion in Chiapas in Mexico, which many see as peasants simply saying, basta, enough, we've had it, we don't want to be developed anymore. So there's a move to contain these threats to their interests. I think there are two ways in which they're seeking to do it. One is to move more and more into biotechnology. And this, for me, is a very frightening prospect. I think that it has incredible environmental risks. Recently, we came across a report in Britain where senior officials in the Minister of Agriculture's research laboratories were writing memos to each other, expressing grave concerns about the risk of genetic transfer between crops and soils.
Can you explain that?
The risk that a genetically modified organism might get out of the crop that it's been embedded in and actually get into the wider environment, that organisms may take it up, soil organisms or whatever. Serious concern about this. And I don't think we know at all what we're doing. We know from past experience with releases of animals such as rabbits in Australia that, you know, you release a new organism into an environment in which it hasn't previously had a niche under which it's controlled, and it can just go like wildflower all over the place. So there's that risk. I think there's also a growing risk that the whole process of agriculture becomes increasingly concentrated within the hands of a very small number. Now, this is already happening, but with biotechnology, it will happen even more so. And that the companies who will have an interest in land will also have an interest in other spheres of life, the life sciences. You're getting a movement by corporations who were traditionally in one field being able to move into a whole range of fields through to biotechnology. And this corporate concentration of control, of power, takes and disempowers the local and ordinary people. Consumers don't have the same relationship that they might otherwise have had with producers. There's a loss of control over that consumers can exert over the production process. There's a loss of control that those farmers who remain on the land, probably under contract to farm to large corporations, because the large corporations will spread the risk that way. There's a loss of control that they have. There's a disempowering. Again, back to this idea of people being thrown onto the corporate rubbish dump. They don't have a place in the system. They don't have a voice in the system any longer. And the social consequences of that, I think, and political consequences, I think, are very, very severe.
Well, let's talk then about the social power of farmers and of people living on the land. One thing that strikes me is that, for example, in one demonstration, October of 93, in Karnataka province in India, there were as many as 800,000 farmers that took to the streets in this demonstration. And as was pointed out to me, that's more farmers than there are in all of Canada. Obviously, in different countries, in different parts of the world, farmers are in very different circumstances and may, in fact, have different bases of power. Given these kind of differences and disparities around the world, where do you see the potentials for alliances being drawn?
In looking at the alliances, I think one needs to look at two things. One are the temporary alliances, the short-term alliances that can be brought together to stop a particular project, like in Karnataka, fighting the Cargill salt plant, the planned Cargill salt plant, which the farmers managed to stop, and they threw Cargill effectively out of India. There are many different alliances at the local level that will come together. More lasting alliances, I think, need to be sort of built up perhaps more slowly and more patiently. And there have been some success stories here. In Britain and in France, two alliances have been spawned between consumers and consumer groups, development groups, small farm groups, and environmental groups. And it's been a very powerful learning process, a process whereby, for example, the organic farmers realized that there was nothing to be gained by saying everyone's got to go organic when they were talking to other farmers who might have wished to go organic but had no option because they didn't have the economic power to do so. It was constrained by debt and other factors from doing so. Environmentalists who previously had been writing off the subsidy system, saying this is what's causing the environmental destruction, by talking to farmers, learned that maybe it's not subsidies per se which are a problem, it's what the subsidies are used to promote and who they go to. Development groups who were able to bring into the melting pot of ideas the concerns of small farmers and producers in the south, what protecting markets in the north would do for those producers, the sort of concerns that farm groups in the north may not have been hearing before. Consumer groups talking about food quality, able to bring out some of their concerns about pesticides and so on to farmers who weren't organic. It's been a very powerful process for evolving new ideas in policy and for giving support to very innovative forms of resistance to the general trend in agriculture. So that farmers, for example, from the more mainstream, who might previously have thought that community-supported agriculture was simply off the wall as an idea, began to realize that, there's something in it for them. This is not just a kooky hippie idea. There are real possibilities there. The consumers who may not have thought about community-supported agriculture before as a way of gaining more control over what they eat and greater links with producers, learning about it for the first time, exploring it, having a forum in which to explore it. And again, so a process of building alliances that will last and which gives support to the many small-scale forms of resistance to the general trend. And it's in those small, little isolated, at times, pockets of resistance that I think the future actually lies. Because however much the corporate world thinks that it's going to have it all its way, it's not. People have always resisted, and I believe very much that ultimately they'll win through.
Is there a particular example that comes to your mind where a small-scale community action can achieve some form of autonomy to these changes that are taking place, this concentration of power on a global scale?
Well, one example that comes to mind is a Shizatsu club in Japan, where consumers in the city have banded together and buy directly from producers in the countryside, organic producers in this case, largely. Other examples from North America of community-supported agriculture, where again consumers have made more direct links with farms, and have participated not only in drawing up the budget for the farm, but in what crops should be grown, and in underwriting the costs, the annual costs of the farm. So the farmer produces what he or she knows they can sell to a group of people who they know want to buy what they have produced, and who have the knowledge that that group of people are going to support them, and they don't have to worry so much about the bank. In my own part of Britain, which is Dorset, there are various schemes of organic producers who have found themselves trapped by the supermarket system. In the mid-80s, they began selling a great deal to supermarkets, and they found themselves in a position where the supermarkets were A, demanding that crops should be grown on a particular date and in particular quantities, and were grading out something like 50% of the crops grown, and that these demands were having very bad effects on the rotation systems that are so necessary for organic farming. They found themselves oppressed by the system and have started instead to sell direct again to consumers through what's known as a box system. And once a week they'll produce a box of vegetables, which the consumer doesn't have much choice in as to what's in there. It's what is available in season. But the producer knows that there is a ready market for it, and has a market. And as that system evolves, so the consumers begin to say, well, actually, look, I'd like to, rather than this potato form of potato, I'd like, can you try growing this one? I think it tastes a bit better. And there are examples of small producers diversifying their crops, massively diversifying their crops, growing 6 or 7 types of potatoes, whereas before they were growing one. And the control that is regained by the farmer and by the producer, by the consumer, is massive. There's a sense of empowerment which wouldn't be there if you were going through the mainstream supermarket system. So these small, they seem terribly insignificant, and when put on a global scale, people say, well, you know, you're not going to change the world like that. But they have ricochet effects, ripples, and they tie in with other initiatives that are happening at the community level to regain some form of control over local environment, local decision making, and so on.
I'm Craig Benjamin. This radio program is part of a series titled Hearing the Voice of the Land, Food, Ecology, and Community. I'd like to thank my guest on today's program, Nicholas Hildyard of The Ecologist. I'd also like to thank Jeffrey Mitchell, who provided original music for this program. If you'd like more information about Hearing the Voice of the Land, or about other programs in the Cassette Culture Catalog, please write to us, care of CFRU FM, Level 2, University Center, University of Guelph, Guelph, Ontario. The postal code is N1G2W1. Thanks for listening.